The headlines: the UN says a recent Iran-Saudi Arabia deal on the resumption of diplomatic ties can prepare the ground for peace in war-torn Yemen. The Syrian president says Damascus welcomes any Russian proposal to boost its troop deployment to Syria. And a new poll shows the recent collapse of a number of major American banks has caused major concerns among U.S. taxpayers. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. The UN Special Envoy for Yemen says a recent Iran-Saudi Arabia deal on the resumption of diplomatic ties can prepare the ground for peace in war-torn Yemen.
Intense diplomatic efforts are ongoing at different levels to bring the conflict in Yemen to an end. We are currently witnessing renewed regional diplomatic momentum, as well as a step change in the scope and depth of the discussions. Allow me to also take this opportunity to welcome the recent agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran to resume diplomatic ties, which was facilitated by the People's Republic of China. This dialogue and good neighborly relations are important for the region and for Yemen.
Grunberg was referring to the China-brokered rapprochement between Tehran and Riyadh. He also told the Security Council that Yemen's warring parties need to seize the opportunity to take decisive steps toward peace. Yemen and Saudi Arabia are currently in negotiations aimed at extending a UN-backed truce that expired in October last year. Riyadh, along with some regional allies and backed by the U.S., launched a war on Yemen back in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Years of aerial strikes and shelling, as well as blockade by the Saudi-led coalition, have devastated the impoverished Arab country and left tens of thousands of civilians dead in Yemen. And the Syrian president has hailed Russia for backing his country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Bashar al-Assad also welcomed any Russian proposal to set up new military base in Syria. Assad, who was on a trip to Moscow, said Russia's support for Syria remains strong despite its special military operation in Ukraine. He noted that the Russian military presence in Syria should not be temporary or merely related to fighting terrorism. Assad also thanked his Russian counterpart for sending aid and rescue teams to help Syrians after a devastating earthquake that hit the northern and western parts of the country. On Wednesday, Vladimir Putin hosted Assad for talks that largely focused on rebuilding Syria and mending its ties with Turkey.
Russian President Vladimir Putin held talks with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in the Kremlin. The head of states of the two countries are in constant contact as relations between Moscow and Damascus are developing in various areas.
Thanks to our joint efforts and the decisive contribution of the Russian armed forces, significant results have been achieved in Syria in the fight against international terrorism. This makes it possible to stabilize the socio-economic and domestic political situation. Unfortunately, the Syrian people faced another very serious problem, a catastrophe, an earthquake. This, of course, exacerbates the situation. As real friends, we are trying to support you. As you know, our units under the Ministry of Emergency Situations also worked here, and representatives of the armed forces stationed in Syria are also contributing to the fight against the consequences of the earthquake.
Meanwhile, Assad expressed support for Russia's special operation in Ukraine and thanked Moscow for its help following the earthquake.
This is my first visit since the beginning of this special operation in Ukraine, and I would like to repeat we fully support your fight against neo-Nazis and old Nazis. I'm talking about the old Nazis, because the West has always received them on the ground and now continues to help them. We support this special operation not because our countries are friends. Our position proceeds from the fact that the world really needs a stabilization now, otherwise it will come to collapse.
This visit has several important components. Syria survived a devastating earthquake with many victims. Syria needs economic help. help and assistance. Syria has problems with energy prices, which have risen. As an important ally of Russia, it will receive this assistance. The second component is no less important. A meeting of representatives of Iran, Turkey and Russia at the level of deputy ministers of foreign affairs is to be held in Moscow, where a potential unfreezing of relations between Damascus and Ankara will be discussed. The very fact of such negotiations in Moscow already speaks of a positive trend.
The situation in Syria and bilateral military cooperation were discussed by the defense ministers of the two countries. Sergei Shoigu, in a conversation with his counterpart Ali Mahmoud Abbas, expressed condolences to the Syrian people in connection with the February earthquake and stressed the importance of close contacts, which are aimed at maintaining stability in the Arab country in the field of defense and the fight against terrorism. The visit by the Syrian president is indicative of strengthening ties between the two countries. The Syrian-Turkish dossier is another important outcome of this visit. The near future will show whether this will lead to the restoration of ties between Syria and Turkey. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Elsewhere, Israeli forces have carried out a fresh raid on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, injuring at least three Palestinians there. The regime's troops stormed the area to provide protection for a number of Israeli settlers who were on their way to break into the archaeological site of Joseph's tomb. That prompted confrontations with the Palestinians. Dozens of Palestinians also suffered from suffocation due to inhaling tear gas fired at them. Israel has been conducting violent raids almost on a daily basis since the formation of the regime's new far-right cabinet under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Since the start of the year, 84 Palestinians have been killed, either by Israel's settlers or forces in the West Bank. Palestinians from the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and Al-Quds took to the streets in support of the Palestinian prisoners in their struggle against the Israeli repressive measures. Dol Al-Asi reports from Gaza.
Every Tuesday, Palestinians in Gaza hold a rally supporting the prisoners. Palestinians in the Palestinian territories and different places across the Gaza Strip took to the street at the same time in what is called marches of anger. Protesters condemned the Israeli crackdown against the prisoners and expressed support for the detainees' civil disobedience actions. Palestinian prisoners in the Israeli jails have pressed ahead for the 30th consecutive day with their civil disobedience actions, protesting the regime's repressive measures initiated by the far-right minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir. With the approaching of the fasting month of Ramadan, the prisoners' disobedience actions are expected to intensify and even culminate to an open-ended hunger strike. The National and Islamic Forces expressed their concerns over the international silence against the Israeli human rights violations and urged the international community to immediately take action.
Today, we call on the international community to fulfill their duties and obligations and save the Palestinian prisoners. We also call on the United Nations to dismiss Israeli envoys Gilad Ardan and Danny Danon.
People of all walks of life expressed their commitment to the prisoners' case and condemned the Israeli repressive campaign against them. Anti-occupation slogans and pro-prisoners banners were raised during the protests. The National and Islamic Committee denounced the Israeli crackdown and said that these measures will never go unpunished by the Palestinian resistance.
These rallies across the Gaza Strip and the occupied Palestinian territories are a message to the Israeli occupation that violating the prisoners' rights is a red line for the Palestinian resistance and the Palestinian people. We will never allow the Israeli occupation to breach the prisoners' case anymore.
As the fasting month of Ramadan approaches, the Israeli regime intensifies its violations against the Palestinian prisoners. In time with other parts of the Palestinian territories, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip confirm their absolute support and readiness to defend the Palestinian prisoners. Al Al-Asib, Gaza.
We're going to rewind to our previous story where Israeli forces have carried out a fresh raid on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Our correspondent Mona Candil is joining us now from Ramallah with more. Mona, what details do you have to share with us and our viewers?
Well, we have to say that Israeli forces continue to raid Palestinian areas on a daily basis, claiming that they want to arrest Palestinians wanted for security reasons or Palestinians known to be fighters or taking part in any anti-Israel operations or activities. But what happened last night, Israeli forces raided Nablus area in order to protect the raid of a number of Israeli settlers who wanted to raid the Qabr Yusuf, Joseph's tomb in Nablus, and it's a site that the Israelis and the Jewish settlers consider very very holy for them, but at the same time it's also a holy site for Muslims, and it's inside the city of Nablus. As usual, clashes took place because Palestinians there tried to push out the settlers out of the site. Clashes erupted between Israeli forces and Palestinians there. As you have mentioned, a number of Palestinians had been wounded, including three of them were shot by live ammunition. At least five were shot by rubber-coated bullets, in addition to dozens, almost over 50 Palestinians have suffered suffocation due to inhaling tear gas. We have to say that elsewhere across the occupied West Bank, a number of Palestinians had been arrested during military raids, according to a statement by the Palestinian Prisoners Society.
All right, thanks a lot. Mona Abkandil joining us from Ramallah. Moving on, Asian stocks have plunged as the liquidity crisis of a Switzerland-based global investment and financial firm evokes fears among investors and creditors. Japan's benchmark Nikkei dropped 1.3%, while Asia-Pacific shares outside Japan fell nearly 1%. Sentiment was fragile and a nervous air hung over market after Credit Suisse's stock plunged as much as 30% overnight, causing the Swiss franc to suffer its biggest drop in 7 years. Credit Suisse has, however, announced that it would borrow over $50 billion from the Swiss Central Bank to reinforce itself. The move follows a decision by the firm's main stakeholders not to inject money to the group. Global stock markets are in turmoil since last week following the collapse of U.S.-based Silicon Valley Bank. And the recent collapse of a number of American banks has caused major concerns among U.S. taxpayers. Now a new poll shows nearly 85% of Americans believe taxpayers should not have to pay a price for problems caused by irresponsible bank management. The two-day survey showed 77% of Americans believe shareholders and executives who profited from a bank in the days before it failed should have to return those funds to depositors. The survey came days after the Silicon Valley Bank collapsed on Friday, causing stock markets around the world to swoon. 2 days later, New York's Signature Bank also closed. On Wednesday, U.S. stocks fell sharply as turbulence at Swiss banking giant Credit Suisse revived fears of a new banking crisis. Well, the U.S. government has threatened TikTok's Chinese owners to sell their shares in the blockbuster app or face a national ban. TikTok replied that if protecting national security is the U.S.'s objective, divestment doesn't solve the problem. It said such concerns will be best addressed via robust third-party monitoring. The U.S. officials and legislators raised fears that TikTok's user data could be passed on to the Chinese government. Last month, the White House gave government agencies 30 days to ensure they do not have TikTok on federal devices and systems. TikTok said, however, it has spent heavily on data security efforts and rejects spying allegations. The app has more than 100 million users in the U.S. Beijing says the true intention of Washington is to further assert its hegemony and deprive China of the right to development. Anger continues to boil over a deadly train crash in Greece, with unions launching a 24-hour walkout with demonstrations over last month's tragedy. The country's leading private and public sector unions have called for walkouts and protests. Flights to and from Greece are grounded and boats remain docked in ports. The action has also caused the closure of public services and schools, as well as the disruption of transport. It's the latest in a series of protests since the head-on collision between passenger and freight trains that claimed 57 lives. The tragedy has triggered daily protests that usually turn violent. Protesters accuse long-running mismanagement of the railway network. The transport minister resigned after the tragedy. Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis has already apologized to the victims' families and promised a thorough investigation. U.S. and South Korean troops have staged joint war games, including air combat operations amid rising tensions on the Korean Peninsula. The drills are part of the ongoing 11-day military exercises dubbed Freedom Shield 23. This comes as North Korea has launched another long-range ballistic missile. The South Korean military says a projectile which was fired from the Sunan area in Pyongyang. Japan also confirmed that the missile was an ICBM, saying that it fell outside the country's exclusive economic zone. The missile launch was the third by the North this week amid large-scale joint military drills by the U.S. and South Korea. The allies claim that such maneuvers are essential for regional and global stability. However, North Korea considers them as a hostile act and a rehearsal for the invasion of its territory. Well, Pakistani High Court has barred police operation for another day to arrest former Prime Minister Imran Khan. The court intervened to tamp down violent clashes between Khan's supporters and police outside his house in the city of Lahore. The court has extended the bar on police operation until Friday. A lower court in Nizamabad had issued arrest warrants for Khan after he failed to appear, citing security reasons. On Wednesday, the former premier announced that he would give a surety bond to appear in the court on March 18th. Last year, a no-confidence motion in parliament resulted in Khan's ouster as prime minister. The chief of the Tehreek-e-Insaf party stands accused of unlawfully selling state gifts while in office. Khan denies any wrongdoing and says the arrest warrant was politically motivated. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Tourism. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, as a reminder, in the previous episode, we briefly talked about some foods in Aliabad Katul of Golestan province. Gilan is another province located in the north of Iran and southwest of the Caspian Sea. It is the land of various delicious foods. Starting with this episode, we will be talking to you on this picturesque province's foods and cuisine of hardworking women of the region. Stay tuned, please. G Gilan is the land of Gilak people. These people shape the major ethnicity in the province, and there are other ethnicities like Deylam, Taleshi, and Turk people of Azeri origin too. Archaeological findings indicate that Gilan has been home to ancient civilizations such as Marlik and Amlash. However, some discoveries show that there had been dwellers in the region from 50 to 150,000 years ago. After the migration of Aryans and other peoples to the region, new ethnicities emerged, but the two ethnicities of Gilak and Deylam had a majority among them. In 6th century BC, Gilak people were united with the Achaemenid king, Cyrus the Great, and overthrew the Median government. After the arrival of Islam in Iran, Gilan turned into the haven of Alawites, and the people of Gilan and Deylaman embraced Islam and became devotees of Imam Ali and his infallible successors. Gilan is the land of brave people who have offered many martyrs in the way of Islam and the country before the Islamic Revolution, during the Revolution, the eight-year imposed war, till this day. However, one of the most famous figures whose name stands brightly in the history of the region is Mirza Kuchak Khan Jangali, who stood against the tyranny of the first Pahlavi ruler Reza Khan until he was brutally martyred by the agents of the tyrant in the frosty mountains of Talish more than 100 years ago. Gilan province is the most humid region in Iran. Favorable climate and fertile soil have made the province capable of growing various plants including legumes, grains, cucurbits, fruits, and so on. Gilan is the first province in Iran in terms of variety with nearly 60 kinds of local food. Gilan is home to the best and most delicious type of rice in Iran. The people of Gilan make use of rice and different types of fish to make tasty foods which attracts every traveler. Creative Cities Network was set up by UNESCO in 2004 to bolster cooperation among member cities. Currently, the network has 116 members. In 2015, Rasht, the center of Gilan province, was chosen by the network as the creative culinary city. This further shows the variety of foods in the region. There are 220 foods and food products in Gilan province. Iranians have known rice since Achaemenid era, over 2,500 years ago. They have grown rice wherever there is water and soil. Yet, Gilan is the best place for growing rice in Iran. As you heard earlier, the people of Gilan also have access to a variety of fish. Hence, they use them in their foods. One of the main factors of high life expectancy in Gilan is the high consumption of fish. In other words, life expectancy was 75 in the region, while it was averagely 72 in the country. Polish researcher of the 19th century, Aleksandr Boreko-Chodzeko, writes in his book Land of Gilan, "In the entire land of Iran, it is only Gilan where there are domestic fowls everywhere, and the skill of the cooks of this region is quite famous, even at the court in Tehran." Another researcher wrote in the 20th century that the people in Gilan rarely consume bread and they often eat rice and fish. In addition to rice and fish, ample jungle fruits and vegetables in different seasons can be another reason for the broad variety of food in Gilan. Gilan province is also famous for unique foods without meat. Mirza Qasemi is one of the most, if not the most, genuine food in Gilan. It is made with eggplant, tomato, garlic, egg, and spices. Dear listeners, after the music, we will explain the recipe for this tasty food. Barbecue the eggplants with peels. Put them in a tray to cool down. Peel off the eggplants and their heads gently. Now slice them under length or mince them completely. Then peel off the tomatoes and grate or puree them. Mince or grate the peeled garlic cloves. Now, put some oil in a frying pan and put it on fire to get hot. Pour the garlic in the pan and saute it for 10 seconds. Then add turmeric, black or red pepper. After 1 minute, break the eggs and mix them with garlic. Take the eggs and garlic out and leave them. Pour the tomato puree in the first frying pan and saute it a little. Add the eggplants with some salt and add some oil if needed. Let them cook on mild fire for half an hour. When the eggplant and tomato are mixed well and the mixture is oily, you can add the mixture of garlic and egg. Now mix everything and then serve it with rice or fresh bread, fresh vegetables, pickled garlic and special olive, seedless olive with pomegranate paste and grated walnuts on it. It should be noted that if you don't like the smell of eggplant peel, you can fry it after peeling it. Mirza Qasemi is a suitable food for vegetarians since it has no meat.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
U.S. depositors are on the edge of their seats as a banking crisis has emerged in that country. So far, three banks have shut their doors with fears of more to do the same. As steep sell-offs are now occurring in the U.S. stock market, the crisis has now spread overseas. Shares in Swiss banking giant Credit Suisse has hit a new low. What are the implications of this crisis? Whatever happened to the U.S. President Joe Biden assuring people not to worry? And is this just a banking crisis, or is this a reflection of deep economic ruptures, especially in the U.S. economy? First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. John Edmonds, professor of finance at Babson College, Wellesley, in Wellesley, Mass., joins us. Also joining us is Peter Koenig, former World Bank economist, who joins us from Lima over in Peru. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. John Edmonds, I'll first start with you, and this is a general question as to see where you stand on this banking crisis, where it's now deepening, obviously. And we're looking at banks, other banks that are feeling the heat, and U.S. stock markets are not doing well. What are we looking at here, John Edmonds?
It's a specific failure of a bank that invested the money coming in a way which was riskier than it should have been, and then they didn't do hedging. It's not the first part of a massive systemic financial crisis like what we had in 2008, 2009. That was a completely different story.
What makes you so sure that it's not a beginning of a wider problem?
Well, it is a wider problem, but what it's doing is putting the spotlight on every bank in the world that isn't doing very well. The bad boy of the moment is Credit Suisse, but they do not have any problem with a maturity mismatch in their bond portfolio. They don't have any massive increase in non-performing loans. What they don't have is they don't have a long-term way of making a profit. Their costs are too high, their revenue is too low, and that's not new. So that stock had been getting hit for a long time. The answer of the Saudis was baked in. They should have known what they were going to be told, because the Saudis couldn't go over 10% ownership of the shares, or it would trigger other factors, other regulatory issues that they didn't want to deal with. And I think also what they really need to do, what Credit Suisse needs to do, is downsize. They've been doing it for years, but they don't seem to be able to do it fast enough.
Peter Koenig, you heard our guest there. Do you agree with what he said?
Yes and no. I would like to add something which so far nobody has actually made the connection to. I think this could be a potential systemic crisis which goes far, far beyond the 2008-2010 crisis, because so far nobody has really officially made the connection to the World Economic Forum, which has said already a long time ago, and it's mentioned in the Great Reset, that there will be a banking crisis. And how do they do that? I mean, it's playing out in front of our eyes, and we can't see it, or we don't want to see it. Behind this banking crisis that has been building up for a long time, behind this banking crisis is an internal crisis of derivatives. You know, these banks, especially the big banks, the so-called systemic banks, big banks, they used to be called too big to fail. They have enormous amounts of outstanding derivatives which are not really money. That's casino money. It's the money that has never been created. It's created just by speculation, and by fast speculation only by financial institutions and banks. So estimates of outstanding, nobody knows exactly how much is outstanding, but estimates range from between 500 trillion to over a quadrillion dollars in derivatives outstanding by the biggest banks. And you know, I'm talking about, not even talking about BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street, but mostly those that are listed and working with Wall Street, like Citibank, Bank of America, Chase, Morgan, and so on. Those have enormous amounts of outstanding. You can imagine what that means. If somebody talks about that, it creates a crisis immediately, and people are going to be afraid. Okay. And we know what the media can do these days. So I think this is part of the reason that this crisis is being generated now.
All right. Before I move on to John Edmonds to get a reaction, can you tell us what the WEF warning was?
Well, this is not new.
John Edmonds, hold on. Let me get. Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead? This is the warning that I looked up, and it said governments have leveraged cheap money to invest in future growth, and to help stabilize distressed financial systems. And I guess there talks about an exorbitant amount of money. What do you think?
Well, yes, I agree with the previous expert. I thought he was also going to mention the exposure to emerging markets, which are always vulnerable to any situation like this, specifically with regard to derivatives. The figure that was tossed around years ago was 600 trillion face value of derivatives. And just for reference, that would be maybe five times the value of annual output in the world. But most of the derivatives are for other purposes, or they're supposed to be actually reducing risk. This is the mistake that the Silicon Valley Bank didn't hedge. They bought long-term bonds and then did not sell them for a future delivery. So you could say their specific problem was not enough derivatives or not the right ones, but But you're quite right that the derivatives are really kind of hidden from view most of the time because of the way they're reported. So you could argue that the precarious nature of the entire world financial system is once again on display. Most of the entities in it have adequate protection, and they also have backing from their government. But we have a bigger threat coming on, which is the House of Representatives might not raise the debt ceiling for the U.S. Treasury, in which case, probably in June or July, the U.S. Treasury would be actually unable to pay bonds that were being presented for redeeming. When a bond matures, you can deliver it to the Treasury, and they're supposed to give you cash, but they wouldn't be able to do that.
Okay. Perhaps that speaks to the wider U.S. economy there. But let's rewind a little bit here, Peter Koenig. On the one hand, you have this Silicon Valley Bank that made the announcement on a Wednesday, and by Saturday, the bank's doors were shut and the announcement was made. And on the other hand, you have the way that this is being reported, and we're going by the way that various news outlets are reporting this, that you have stocks that are in sell-off mode, but this is the part that's most important, that there are worries that more lenders could fail. How is it that you have institutions, organizations that are supposed to monitor this, like the SEC in the U.S. and others, and yet you have these bank failures that are showing up the way they do, especially at warp speed, may I add, in the case of SVB? I mean, aren't they supposed to be monitoring this? And how could they not know that other banks are in distress unless they don't want to make that announcement yet, because it would obviously lead to more public outrage and worry, and obviously that could spell, for example, a run on the banks.
Well, right. I mean, the point is that they do know. It's not that they don't know, but the government knows, and the so-called regulatory agencies, which they are practically none anymore for the banking sector, they are aware of the risk, and they are purposefully they don't do anything. And why? I mean, the banking sector has been largely deregulated by the Clinton administration in 1999. This has been then a big scandal and has made the round in the media, but in the meantime has been forgotten. Nothing has changed. The banking, particularly as far as derivatives concerned, is still totally deregulated. So the banks can do whatever they want. They can lend and borrow whatever they want. They don't have a ceiling anymore. They used to have ceilings. This is all gone. And now comes the fact that we also have to mention, because there are many dimensions to this, the Federal Reserve has, within the last half a year or so, has rapidly increased the interest rates to levels which has not been seen during the last three decades, at least. You know, and that has made banks insecure, has lenders made insecure, businesses also, of course, so they became very much scared of borrowing money. And this has contributed also to a contraction of the banking sector. On the other hand, the interest rates, the increase of interest rates have brought a shock, sure, in not only to the banking sector as a whole, but only to business. And so they have become, mm-hmm, very much cautious on what they're gonna do in the future. Now, why is the banking sector not being regulated? I mean, it's almost totally deregulated, and there are parts of the banking sector which should be at least regulated or abandoned altogether. Like I find the casino money play, the, sure, games with derivatives should be stopped or at least regulated. But there's such a strong lobbying from the big financial institutions with Congress that this hasn't happened and doesn't happen probably within the foreseeable future, mm-hmm, until a catastrophe will happen. And, okay, and so these are additional facts that need to be added into this potential crisis.
Sure. John Edmonds, let's talk about these interest rates topic here, because what we're looking at is both SVB and Signature Bank that's another bank that went bankrupt. There were actually, from what the report says, there were overly exposed to assets whose values came under pressure from rising interest rates. Tell us how that leads to the banks closing down. What it means?
Well, let me just describe bank regulation as it was classically imposed at the end of the 1980s. A bank is supposed to have stockholders' equity equal to or greater than 8% of risky assets, and their bonds are not supposed to be risky. But what happened was those banks bought long-term fixed-rate bonds, which then declined in value because of their rising interest rates. So instead of their loan portfolio being a source of headaches, it was their bond portfolio, and suddenly they found themselves in a situation where by operation of rules, they would have to be liquidated. But the point about derivatives that the other person is mentioning is entirely correct. They say they were supposed to be regulated in the Dodd-Frank law, and the documents that were floating around after that were not really decisive. So it's possible, if you're clever, to circumvent the regulation and take advantage of the very low cost money. The other relevant point is that interest rates were very low in Japan from 1990 onward, and in the rest of the world from the year 2000 onward, and especially from 2008 onward. So bankers lived there pretty much their entire career in a very low interest rate environment, and they were expecting that the low interest rates would continue. So they took in deposits on which they were offering to pay very low interest rates, and then they invested the money in something that was supposed to yield more, which it would do, except that then when interest rates went up, their cost of money went up and their return on portfolio went down. So they were still getting the coupon payments from these bonds, but they suffered a capital loss on the bonds. And that was fatal for at least two of them.
Okay, so let's try to break that down. Peter Koenig, what our guest there said. If I was somebody watching this, I might be a little confused, but let me see if this makes sense, whether I'm right in looking at it this way, because maybe some viewers might also look at it this way. So you have the bank, they took in the money from an average person, and they took that money and they invested it in something else, but because the interest rates on the money rose, the bank was not able to make the money back in terms of the ratio or the percentage that it wanted to, and it fell short in terms of giving the money back to the customer?
If you take in money from a depositor and tell them you're going to pay them 1%, and then you take that money and invest it in something that's supposed to yield 4%, that's 4% isn't really high enough to cover the bank's cost of salary and overhead and things like that. But suppose that we just talk about 4% and 1%. It should be making 3%, but what happens on that is they couldn't consistently make enough on the money that they were lending out, and so they went to other things which were maybe more speculative, and that will come out soon.
How long has this been going on, you think?
Well, it's been going on for quite a long while since after Dodd-Frank, which was in 2010. There was supposed to be a regulation about derivatives, and they tossed that back and forth. And I only followed it for a while, but every 6 months.
But the interest rates have been going up for the past year, haven't they?
Well, yeah, but exactly. I mean, with regard to the accounting for derivatives and regulating.
Okay, let me get Peter Koenig back in here, John Edmonds. So since 2010, Dodd Franklin is what our guest there talked about. Sorry to have cut you off there, John Edmonds.
No, go ahead.
Peter Koenig, to you. Since 2010, as our guest there said, since Dodd Franklin, but more specifically in the past year or so, when the Fed stepped in to raise interest rates to try to tame inflation. So they've known about this, I'm guessing, in the past year. But now we're seeing the results, or now is the time that we're seeing things unfold. Is that correct, Peter Koenig?
Yes, I would agree with that. And what has actually happened during this long period of low interest rates or almost zero interest rates, you know, the banking system has become less fair. Sort of has taken a less fair attitude in terms of lending, particularly, and have not looked very much at the risks, because the risks were kind of low with the low interest rates. They didn't risk very much, but they could produce money. for the system. As you know, in the U.S., probably more than 95% of the money generated in circulation is made by the private banks by establishing loans, not by the Federal Reserve. So all of that has helped the private banking sector enormously. Now, suddenly there is a surge of interest rates, as you said, within the last year or so, to what it is now, close to 5% or something like that. This is enormous, from zero within a year. And that, of course, reflects on the lending. This is just for prime lenders. And that has an enormous impact, as I mentioned before, not only on business itself, but also on the banks. And therefore, this is certainly a point that has to be taken into very much into account in the current crisis.
So you have what's going on in the States, and then you have now what has happened overseas. John Edmonds, taking a look at bank shares that have fallen in Asia and in Europe, of course, stock markets also. But in particular, what seems to be making some noise here is Credit Suisse, where there has been, it's closed down 30%, it's nosedived to a historic low. You have the U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders saying that everybody is concerned about the impact of Credit Suisse problems on the U.S. banking system. And you have the U.S. Treasury officials who are monitoring the problems, and they're contacting their, counterparts. So doesn't that mean that there is exposure? And it sounds like they're not saying something about this, but exposure, I mean that, you know, these banks are related, these financial institutions, banks, to their overseas, to the banks overseas. Are we correct in this?
Oh, yes, absolutely. They have lines of credit with each other, but also the central banks have lines of credit with each other, and they're constantly in communication with each other. But I wouldn't limit it to Credit Suisse. The two largest banks in Germany have been operating below book value per share for most of the past 15 years. And they make a little bit of money one quarter and lose a little bit the next quarter, but they're not really earning enough to be staying in business. But that's moving right on. I'd mentioned the Japanese banks, which depended on zero interest rates for the longest time, and interest rates in Japan have been held still in the 1% range and finally are being allowed to creep up in the 2% range. But even that is traumatic for a country that had effectively 0% interest from 1990 onward. You could have a very successful career in banking in Japan, allocating money that isn't really costing you anything, and you didn't really have to charge the borrowers very much for the money either. So they could borrow money, and then when it came time to pay it back, they could just borrow some more and use the new money to pay the old money.
Okay.
That's now coming to roost.
Exactly. And that's what we're looking at. And it seems like, Peter Koenig, that this easy money is at the heart of the problem, isn't it? Isn't that the real fact here? But if it's easy money and they took it, they being the banks, financial institutions, or what have you, why were they not able to generate enough money in order for them not to see the day that we're seeing now? Because from what we understand, the easy money stopped within the past year. Isn't that correct?
Peter, I would say within the last 6 to 12 months. That is correct. But you know, this is a very short period of time for the banks to refinance themselves after having been overly exposed and taking many risks. This is a very short period of time, especially since it's the banks themselves who have taken advantage of the low interest rates and created more money by giving more credit to institutions which may have been not the most risk-free institutions or businesses. So I think, yes, this is one thing. Then secondly, I don't believe that many people have foreseen what was going to happen in terms of interest rate increases. Yes, we have been told before that the Fed will increase interest rates, and as a consequence, usually Europe does too. And so, yes, this was out there, but it has not happened for such a long time, and we were crying wolf for too long. And so eventually when it started happening, nobody was really prepared.
Sure.
And this is what's playing out today. This is part of what's playing out today. But okay. I would like to come back to the other factor with which we started, and this is the derivatives, because we have also publicity. You know, we have the media that say anything they are paid to say. And if they make propaganda with the overextension on derivatives of the banks, that has an immediate impact, maybe not on the direct the small consumers, but on businesses. And if we look at these, and of course these big banks, they know that. If they have a quadrillion outstanding, I don't know exactly, nobody knows the figure, but let's put it that way. A quadrillion is about 10 times more than the current world GDP. Can you imagine? A
right,
quadrillion
indeed.
Of casino money compared to
sure.
created money with the world's GDP. So if that floats out, you have an enormous for this kind of angst created, and people may
okay.
May actually not just run the banks for their cash, but banks also may start running other banks for their outstanding derivatives,
right.
And that creates a
sure. Well, sorry to jump in because we just have a minute left here, and I'd like to go to you, John Edmund. So, whatever happened to the U.S. President Joe Biden? Words of assurances didn't really pan out, did he? Did it? I mean, he said, one of the quotes, no losses will be borne by the taxpayers. Let me repeat that, no losses that the taxpayers have to pay. But at the same time, we know that some of the bank fees obviously play into that, that the taxpayers will have to pay for it. But he's not making that much of a dent in the sentiment out there. And final question to you, John Edmonds, how are you and your friends feeling about this? I'm just wondering, generally speaking, the American public. Are you guys thinking we should take our money out of the bank? Is that the general sentiment?
Some do, but I personally am not worried at all because of what Joe Biden said. That is to say, there are guarantee funds in existence that can buttress the banks. This was a guarantee fund that was created in the 1930s called the FDIC, and then a second one which came out of Dodd-Frank, and that part did work. But still, I think it is correct that the taxpayers ultimately will suffer if there's any economic downturn. They would
okay.
make less money, but they wouldn't be on the hook definitely for bailing out a bank. And specifically, bank executives will not walk away from this with enormous severance packages. I really don't expect that. This will be different in that regard.
Thank you very much. We're going to unfortunately have to end in there. John Edmonds, professor of finance at Babson College in Wellesley. Thank you. Peter Koenig, former World Bank economist from Lima, Peru. Thanks. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Ikava Tawe and the team. It's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamate began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed imam from among the household of the Messenger of Allah. And Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet. We find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam lived a short period of his holy life in the city of Baghdad. While he was in the city of Baghdad, he tended towards knowledge and wisdom, and his eminence established the basis and the principles of knowledge, and he made use of the period of his stay in Baghdad in order to spread knowledge and wisdom and teach the different sciences and to merge the intellect with the Islamic sciences and literature. A great number of scholars and narrators joined Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam to learn from his eminence the different Islamic sciences such as theology, philosophy, jurisprudence, and the interpretation of the Quran, the tafsir.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam, the ninth divinely appointed imam. We find, dear friends, that in the time of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, the environment and the ambiance was such that there was various different theological and philosophical schools of thought. Of course, this was partly in due to the fact that there were external influences such as different theologies, ideologies, and philosophies which were coming into the Islamic world from different parts of the rest of the world. So you had this Roman, Greek, and Roman philosophies, and then you had the philosophies from the science side of the Asia, whether it was Hind, which is known as India in the present day, or Sindh, which according to some interpretations is present day Pakistan, or Sin, which is supposed to be China. So all of these different philosophies were coming from the outside into the Muslim world. And on the other hand, we find that within the Muslims, there was a lot of discrepancies and a lot of differences with one another, of course, because they had not taken the axis known as imama and wilaya the way that the Almighty Allah had wanted them to. So when you don't have an axis or a central point to refer to which is connected to the Almighty Allah, then discrepancies and differences do arise. One of the things that would be spoken about was fate in the time of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. So when somebody